From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
Arkansas is once again sending out cancellation notices for Medicaid. Meanwhile, the governor wants to continue its expansion.
Arkansas's inmate population reaches an all-time high as state lawmakers approve funding for more beds.
Leaders of the Pulaski County and Jacksonville school districts struggle over control of facilities planning under an ongoing desegregation order.
And Arkansas's top economic development official says we should know soon whether the state will get a massive military contract to build the next generation of combat vehicles. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
That's all coming up next on KUAR's Weekend Review. This week, Arkansas resumed issuing cancellation notices to Medicaid recipients who didn't respond within the allotted time frame of 10 days. The governor had issued a short-term halt for a couple of weeks as he gave the Department of Human Services a chance to catch up with the paperwork that had been going into that office. And Jacob, also the governor, spoke to a legislative committee looking at this. But first, on the cancellations, any hesitation on the part of the governor to have this resume?
You know, in the days leading up to it, it seemed like there's a little bit of hesitation. No one would really give a clear answer when the 2-week pause was supposed to end. But in the press conference, he was pretty clear. He said, we're going to resume terminations. He said the backlog of information had been concluded, though there's some debate about if that's to the extent in which it was really concluded. The Department of Human Services, the governor ramped up staff significantly. A few hundred workers working overtime hours in addition to new temporary workers and county officers having to stop what they were doing for the county and reallocate their time to help process this stuff. And that's still expanding. It's still not up to speed, so that administrative cost will still grow. But the verification letters are still going out. And the other part of that announcement is that there'll be some relief for those 48,000 or so that are set to lose their coverage by the end of this month. And those people did not have the due process that the rest of these people will have after the 2-week pause. And the governor talked about two of the state's three insurance carriers in the private option deciding that they would offer pharmacy coverage.
DHS has worked with the insurance carriers, and a majority of the insurance carriers has agreed to, for their clients to go ahead and cover the medication requested at the pharmacy, even though that individual has been declined coverage.
And it's important to note that while he said that, it's not all of the carriers will. So if you happen to have QualChoice, you're out of luck. You're not going to get those same benefits that the rest of the Medicaid population gets. They just won't be able to get their pharmacy coverage covered, and they might find out when they go to buy their prescriptions and can't afford it. And also those that are not included are about 6,000 or 7,000 of the state's most vulnerable people who, instead of getting private insurance through the private option, they're instead put on traditional Medicaid. And those are people who are medically frail, and it also includes some kids on Our Kids First. So some of the most endangered people in terms of their precariousness of their life, they're not getting that pharmacy coverage, and they're not going to get the same due process that the next round of verification letters will. But the reason why those two of the three pharmacy coverages will be covered, the governor said, kind of as an admission about the fault of the previous process, is because he said a lot of those people that were kicked off may in fact actually be still eligible. It's just they didn't get the letter, they didn't send it in time, or DHS simply failed to process it in time, even though they did everything right.
They're going to go ahead and cover that for those on their list of beneficiaries, with the hope, I guess, or the understanding that if that person is later determined to be eligible, then the insurance carrier will be paid the premium, and it will all be retroactive to the cutoff date, back to the original, and so there would not be any gap in coverage. So that's minimizing the risk of pharmaceuticals, medication, not getting to people in need whenever there might be some argument that they are still eligible for the Medicaid coverage.
But conceivably, this backlog could develop once again because there's still that 10-day window in terms of people verifying their income, though the governor did note there might be a little bit of new wiggle room. There's also a 10-day processing at the end of that 10-day window, so maybe 20 days, you could say. But that's certainly not something he emphasized. The governor wanted to appear resolute, that he said the 10-day window is a thing of personal responsibility that people really just need to do.
And so if somebody is not going to respond to requests from DHS for information, they're not going to respond in 10 days and 30 days. And so 10 days invigorates the process earlier.
But many of these people will be reapplying in the next 90 days for coverage, so DHS will be inundated with a different type of information to process.
Well, it sounds like then with DHS already struggling to maintain the caseload and having to bring in extra workers, that then there will be more problems in the future.
Right, and this is the first time, to the state's credit, that they've had to verify the expanded Medicaid population. They're supposed to do it annually. So the hope is that they'll figure out how to do it a different way next time, but this should all be done, I believe, by the end of September. But at this point, there are a lot of workers working overtime. You got to wonder how sustainable that is to ask someone to work 50 or 60 or 70 hours a week. And also, when county offices are doing something they're not intended to do, there's got to be some slack elsewhere.
And the cancellations will be up to nearly 50,000 Arkansans who have been canceled by the end of the month.
That's right. And so far, they've reinstated only around 2,000 of those. And the governor seems to think when it's all said and done, out of the 250,000 people in the private option part of Medicaid, that around 30,000 will be kicked off.
I have a question about, obviously, the governor said this before the healthcare legislative task force. I don't know the official name on that one, unfortunately. But what sense do you get from lawmakers or others on that task force about how this process is going? Are there grumblings about the speed or the backlog or the cost of the actual verification process?
Democrats have seemed to come out of the woodwork a little bit the past month, especially with Medicaid. They're very critical of the process. They say the governor's not doing it well in terms of fiscal responsibility for the state, in terms of management, and in terms of valuing the people that are losing their insurance. Some relatively moderate Republicans like David Sanders of Central Arkansas, who's one of the main architects of the private option, he's been mildly critical of the 10-day window. But in general, I think especially for his base, the conservative part of the Republican Party, they really like this because they think that there are a lot of people who are on Medicaid who maybe make too much money to really be on it, or they're taking an advantage of something for free and aren't even working hard enough at their benefit to fill out some paperwork. So they see this as a positive thing. It'll obviously save money if these people aren't being paid for by the government to have insurance.
Well, Jacob, while the cancellations continue, the governor did this week say he does actually want this Medicaid program to continue.
Basically, I think the big takeaway is that Medicaid expansion should continue, and using the framework of the private option certainly is part of his vision. But he said he does want some additional waivers approved. He had played a little bit of hardball after his remarks to the press, saying, well, I want it to continue as long as we get these waivers. But the governor was clear to legislators. It was kind of a big speech. They got out a tabletop lectern for it. He had a PowerPoint that he lectured on, as he has to legislators, really walking them through his arguments in a kind of technocratic way. But the governor said that continuing the private option or Medicaid expansion, part of the Affordable Care Act, was good, of course, for the people who gained health care coverage, and also good for hospitals, really reducing uncompensated care costs. So he both made a fiscal argument for the state, because we stand to save about $400 million a year with Medicaid expansion. It's a total of about $1.7 billion contributed to the state's economy through Medicaid. And he also made a values-based case saying, you know, I made a promise that, you know, I just don't think it's okay to kick 200,000 people off their insurance without some sort of recourse. But he talked to the base of his party, and he really talked to what some of them want to do, just ending it outright. But he really said that if you look at the cost and what his Arkansas values are, his morals, that seems like a tough choice, but he presented it to lawmakers.
That is an objective that I have. So coming back to our decision tree, one option that we have as a state, we have that prerogative. We can say no to Medicaid expansion. We can say we do not want to have that coverage and we want to end it that is an option. Again, the results I've already recited is $1.4 to $1.7 billion drained out of our Arkansas economy. 220,000 will have their health care coverage ended.
And so then the question becomes, if you do accept that premise that we should get rid of it, the governor says, well, what would we turn back to? And that's a message towards his party base also that had a real fury in 2013, really opposed to this part of the Affordable Care Act. And in 14, they thought, oh, with the private option sunset at the end of 2016, this is, you know, we were told in the spring that this was ending the private option, ending Medicaid expansion. But the governor kind of said, well, what are we going to turn back to then?
And we have to remember that the previous system that relied upon prior to the private option has been dismantled. Our system in Arkansas of charity care, of uncompensated care, of clinics across this state that would provide medical care to those that did not have insurance or health coverage. That system has been dismantled. The uncompensated care coverage has been dismantled. Everything has changed since it was a couple years ago prior to the private option.
And this next bit is really, I think, the only thing you need to hear about what Asa Hutchinson feels about this. It's a little long, but he really makes the case in terms of the fiscal impact on the state, his personal moral values. And he says in the end, Arkansas really only has one option, whether we keep Medicaid expansion or not.
Do we want, as a state, to say no to Medicaid expansion when we're going to draw that money out of our economy, and more importantly, 220,000, there's really no reasonable plan to address their health care coverage. Now, if you conclude that we should not leave those 220,000 without a solution, if you remember in my UAMS speech, that was one of the points that I made, we're a compassionate state, we're not going to leave the 220,000 without some recourse, without some access to care. And it could have been a whole host of combinations, from the state developing its own system of care to going back to charity care, many options, but those options have been more narrowed since that time. And so if you conclude that we can't leave those 220,000 without some type of health care, then that brings you to another decision point. And that is, we either pay for their coverage as a state and absorb those dollars out of our state revenue budget, or we do it in partnership with the federal government. I have not talked to many that believe we can absorb the coverage for 220,000 out of state general revenues. And if you reach that conclusion that we cannot do that, then that leaves you with only one option. And that is, the federal government started this program with 100% coverage. Arkansas can't absorb that. So if we continue to provide the care for the 220,000 and access to health care, we have to have some form of Medicaid expansion with a combination of federal and state dollars. And then you have to make plans for the state share and how we're going to cover that.
Well, very compelling argument there from the governor. What was the reaction from his fellow Republicans?
I talked to a few that were already opposed to the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion in the past. And in general, they all point back to they don't think Medicaid expansion should be continued because even if it saves money for the state, it's still part of the federal deficit. And so they think it's kind of delusional to only think in terms of state savings when we're also citizens of the United States. But on the other hand, they don't really have a solution in terms of how to make up for that $400 million deficit that would happen for the state, which is a much bigger deficit than the $50 million the governor says we have to make up by 2021. But he outlined seven key points to do so. And they're, you know, a little strange, I think, to some conservatives, maybe. One of the big ones, cost-saving ones, is to take people off of the private coverage and push them back into traditional Medicaid, which would just be a straight Obamacare expansion. And the other one would be to try to get employers to cover more of the cost. And Republicans have vocally been against the idea of an employer mandate. So those are two key provisions. And so one of the main things that people have been pointing towards, opponents of this program, was that there should be some work requirement. If you're going to get Medicaid expansion, you have to work. And the governor said, well, we'll have a work referral, which doesn't sound quite as dramatic.
And we had talked about this a little earlier this week, in that Arkansas tends to rank very poorly in terms of public health and the health and well-being of its citizens. And that also has an effect on the costs of covering people for health-related issues. Is there any discussion as to maybe instigating some preventative kind of programs to promote better health of its citizens?
Yeah, that's something that's definitely on the table. On the next day, the Health Reform Legislative Task Force, chaired by Hutchinson's nephew, who's the Senate Republican Majority Leader, they talked about that with the Chancellor of UAMS, Dan Ron, saying that, hey, we're 49th in terms of health. If you want to cut down on how much money we spend, we need a healthier population. And the way to do that is through preventative practices, through better coordination of services so different medical professionals don't act in silos, so to speak. But I guess to sum it up, in terms of your question earlier, Michael, is the Republican Party buying into it, which controls most of the seats in the state legislature? It seems like, yeah, they know it saves money. They know that it's generally good for people to have health insurance. They don't really like Medicaid expansion. But it seems like they're going to go along with it. I can't imagine they wouldn't.
This week, Arkansas's prison population again reached a record high number of inmates. And it comes as state lawmakers met this week at the Capitol on 2 days to discuss the ongoing problem, what can be done to, first off, create more beds that can house prisoners so we can reduce the backlog of state inmates being held at county jails. But also, there's ongoing talk about programs to help the reentry process. And you also have more inmates who are being sent down to the Bowie County, Texas jail. Chris and Sarah, you both covered hearings this week. Chris, on Thursday, you heard as a lot of officials discussed the challenges and what are the best approaches to take.
Yeah, and I guess one of the big pieces of news from that hearing of the Charitable Penal and Correctional Institution Subcommittee of the Arkansas Legislative Council, they heard from a few prison officials, correction officials. Wendy Kelly, director of the ADC, said as of Thursday, 19,055 inmates were under Department of Correction jurisdiction, the most ever in Arkansas up to this point. Of those, about 2,700 are in county jails now. And that was a point that was that still raises the ire of a lot of legislators and, of course, county officials around the state have been making a fuss about the backlog of state prisoners in their jails being a very costly thing, but also just in terms of administrating and providing bed space for prisoners, it's just becoming more and more of a challenge. And this all goes back to 2013 when the Board of Correction instituted new parole rules, making the consequences for parole violators much stricter. As a result, we've seen a lot of parole violations and a lot of parolees who violated the terms of their parole sent back to prison, even in a lot of cases before they've been reconvicted of crimes. So at this committee hearing, Wendy Kelly talked a little bit, mentioned briefly about how she's been visiting and also in contact with other states and a lot of privately operated facilities. She visited ones in Louisiana, in Tennessee. I think she said she was in contact with one in Oklahoma to continue to look at more options. As you mentioned, Michael, Bowie County in Texas has about a little more than 300 state inmates currently being housed. Earlier this year, the legislature approved a contract with them. But this issue of overcrowding and continuing to try to come up with options to get more bed space somewhere has a lot of lawmakers flummoxed. And here's Stephanie Flowers, Democratic state senator from Pine Bluff, talking to Wendy Kelly about this issue of overcrowding and asking her kind of, you know, where we are in comparison to the other states.
So do they have no issues with overcrowding? I mean, have you become aware of any issues with overcrowding in any of these places that that you visited or contacted?
Where they're trying to offer us bed space?
Yes.
They have a lot of empty beds.
And, I mean, is there not any inquiry as to why? I mean, they're in another state. Most states, to my knowledge, have overcrowding issues. So, I mean, why would they be so available and the state not use it?
Well, actually, nationwide, I think prison populations have dropped, but not in Arkansas.
Well,
we're going the other way.
Are you saying Louisiana has dropped?
I know that they have empty facilities. I've seen them.
So you can hear there's a little bit of frustration, but it's like there's not, you know, a really systematic solution to the overcrowding. It's we're continuing to seek bed space. There was some approval for funding last week for more beds, and again on Friday. And Stephanie Flowers went on with her line of questioning, and she referenced this issue with county jails being overcrowded. And there was an issue, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, in Jefferson County, a prison riot there, destruction of property. And the implication there is that, you know, it was likely the result of poor conditions. And here's their exchange on that.
I'm trying to figure out what happened down there in Jefferson County, because when I saw a picture the next day, there were mats on the floor. And so it appeared to be above capacity.
I don't think it's just Jefferson County that has had mats on the floor. I think that there are other counties that also have inmates that have been on the floor.
Well, we had an incident down there that many called a riot, and it caused destruction of property in the interior of the jail. So can you comment on that? I mean, on whether it was inmates that had been committed to ADC involved or what? Have you all had an investigation? What?
No, ma'am. We don't investigate at the county jail level. I know what I read in the paper. But they didn't contact us and say that it was your inmates that caused this problem.
And other lawmakers there, you know, asked if there would be a timeline for, you know, getting more prisoners out of the county jails. In fact, Kelly said there were actually 380 inmates at that Jefferson County facility, and the official capacity there was 315. About 40% of those inmates there were state prisoners. So you can kind of get a sense of, like, you know, in that specific example, how much the overcrowding is. And they released like a spreadsheet showing in most of the state prisons that have more than 1,000 beds, I mean, they're all over 100% capacity. So it's become quite an issue that, you know, is not really, you know, there's no long-term solution going on.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, you covered a hearing on Friday where lawmakers did approve some at least short-term fixes.
Yeah, lawmakers approved $10 million in funding to open 200 beds in facility in Pine Bluff, and then 58 beds more in the Bowie County, Texas, where the state started sending inmates there. So I spoke with Wendy Kelly also, and she said that there are already other requests in the governor's office for funding increases, including a $3 million increase for beds in a Ouachita facility. She spoke about the parole board's consideration of rules for parolees who are returning before they complete their parole terms, and that's causing one of the greatest increase in the recidivism rate. So the parole board's considering now whether to change some of those rules that they've implemented. She also said the parole board has been reluctant to lessen parole, or has been reluctant to release parolees in general, and that overall, the issue is just now being addressed at the state level in a real fundamental way. So the reentry programs are getting started. Community partners are getting involved. The governor's interfaith summit at the end of this month to get faith leaders talking about how they're going to help hasn't happened yet. And the 500 beds that were funded earlier this year haven't been opened. So the department is obviously overwhelmed and hadn't anticipated needing this new funding increase, let alone the others they're asking for now, and had hoped that their reentry efforts would be working sooner. She said she didn't really expect to see a big change necessarily even within the year. So she seemed a bit weary, but that's the situation at hand.
And worth noting just that this all stemmed from state lawmakers really cracking down on parole absconders after he had Daryl Dennis, an 8-time offender, commit a murder. And that really got a lot of attention. And so you've had a drastic spike in the prison population in the last couple of years because of that.
She did mention a couple of small reforms they've started on recently as well, including they're giving inmates a little bit more money when they let them go on parole, from $100 to $125, but 75 of that is contingent on coming to the first parole visit. And they're assigning mentors to parolees and also making a parole plan about 4 months before the release date. So these are outside of the reentry programs, but seems like officials are trying to do everything they can think of to stem this tide.
Just wanted to say, it seems like lawmakers and the governor certainly have been responsive to the counties, and they hear this outcry, allocating $40 million for the $33 million from the regular session and the $10 million passed this week is a lot of money, and it's something that they would not spend on a lot of different programs. That kind of money's off the table. So they have responded, but maybe it's still an inadequate action. But I want to ask Sarah and Chris, since you've been covering these committees, there's been a lot of talk about additional bed space, about reforms to the parole system and reentry systems. You mentioned the Faith Summit. A judge and minister in Little Rock, Wendell Griffin, has been critical of this, saying the real problem is the sentencing laws themselves. Has anyone been talking about that?
I mean, it wasn't mentioned specifically in the hearings, although I'll reiterate, I kind of mentioned this before, is that, you know, with the, as you said, Michael, the new restrictions on parole violators and returning them back to parole, a lot of them are being sent back to prison after they've been charged with new crimes. So there's kind of a unique aspect of this that is kind of lost in the conversation, in that a lot of the spike in the prison population is the result of there being a charge rather than a sentence. And eventually, a sentence might be carried out. But, you know, I think a lot of the corrections officials themselves are very concerned with the task at hand, which is finding space for the, I mean, they, you know, obviously lawmakers and people on the Board of Corrections can enact policies. And of course, people in the Department of Community Correction who are tasked with helping transition folks back to society are concerned with it. But I mean, from the most part, you know, it's like they have this very immediate responsibility of finding a way to deal with this problem, which is kind of snowballing, and it's taking away money from general revenue that could be spent toward more reentry programs and stuff.
I think that as Michael was mentioning, the parole rule changes that happened in 2013 after the Daryl Dennis parole absconder, who was charged recently with killing an 18-year-old, and the news of his story caused a lot of concern among prison officials and led to these changes. Arkansas is among other states in the nation that has strict sentencing laws and prison overcrowding issues, and it seems the difference here is some of those parole release rule changes that have caused spikes here that have set the state on a much faster course for prison overcrowding than other states. So in 2013, the rates were significantly higher than anywhere in the nation. and consultants who've come to the legislature in recent months to talk about escalating rates looking forward in the next 10 or 25 years, the issue that they pointed out was what Chris was talking about, was this one anomaly of a rearrest based on a charge after parole. So there's that doesn't happen elsewhere the way it does here, that parolees are just automatically funneled back into the system before they even get through the parole process in some kind of unnecessary ways. So I guess to the best that I can answer your question, I don't think there's any discussion that I've heard about sentencing rates, and that might not be a problem that's specific to Arkansas in the way that some of these other problems are.
Well, at the summit that we mentioned will be taking place on Tuesday and Wednesday, and one of the key goals that the governor is hoping faith-based leaders can address is helping to find more support to help people when they come out on parole. And we'll be speaking with the governor on Monday morning. We expect to be talking with him, and so hopefully we'll have more from him to advance that summit. This week there was a status hearing in the long-running desegregation battle in Pulaski County. This has mainly involved the three school districts, but with the fourth one, now the Jacksonville North Pulaski County School District, being created by voters there. There was also talk about the future of that district, and in particular, who should run facilities and other aspects of the district. Sarah, you covered a hearing in federal court on Thursday. Tell me a little about what's being considered here and what the real contentious issues here are.
Well, as the Jacksonville School District develops plans for separating from the Pulaski County Special School District fully by this 2016-2017 school year, issues are rising around decision-making authority in areas that are subject to a desegregation order that the district's been under for a long time. And Pulaski County Special School District Superintendent Jerry Guess is experienced and respected for his knowledge of how to handle some of these areas, and he's made some progress. Pulaski County is nearly unitary in the staffing category, and there are various other categories that he's trying to get complete and free of the desegregation order, including student achievement, discipline, and facilities. So in federal court yesterday, Judge D. Price Marshall affirmed that Jerry Guess does indeed have authority to be the sole decision maker in all these areas as long as the new district is under control of the county district. So I spoke with him after the hearing.
I think there can really only be one person responsible for those issues. Not to say that Jacksonville's role isn't important. I think what that simply means is we have to work together and agree. It's my ultimate responsibility to be sure that those obligations outlined in the DSEG program are met. And I'm humbled by that responsibility and the judge's words.
So the whole process of the separation of Jacksonville has been sort of a precedent setting. Both districts have sort of been playing it by ear and taking it step by step. And the district needs to come up with a facilities plan by February that would last for several years ahead. And then any buildings that would be planned now, you know, could last decades. And their point is that they want to allow their citizens and their representatives to choose where they build and what they do, and have been in conversation about creating a new plan that would actually give them authority before February to take over facilities as their purview in the situation. And so the judge affirmed that Guess is in control and that he's frustrated by how this process has been playing out. He feels like it's becoming contentious, and the point of these status update hearings every several months is to talk about how to make progress on resolving the issues of desegregation. This whole situation is further complicated by all of the complicated racial equality issues involved. So apparently the district, Jacksonville district, had been reaching out to consultants for building projects and also had hired one consultant that Superintendent Guess objected to and vetoed that hire. And this launched this whole controversy and a proposed new plan that would resettle some of the power, the controls of facets of the facilities plan.
And Sarah, when we're talking about the desegregation case and categories like facilities. Can you explain a little bit about what these unfulfilled categories mean, the reason for the court involvement? Is it saying that basically in Pulaski County School District in the past, which included Jacksonville, that they've failed to have equal and adequate facilities for people of all races? Is that the reason behind this stuff?
Yeah, so this is a decades-old desegregation case that Attorney John Walker brought to federal court. He and his organization, the Joshua Interveners, are still involved in representing the rights of minority students. And so there are certain requirements in each of these areas that are specified in terms of what it really takes to become equal racially in areas in terms of hiring practices and building practices, site selection for schools, and how that will disadvantage certain populations residing in certain parts of town. For example, in Jacksonville, the African-American population is heavily concentrated in the center of the city. So if the facilities plan included a high school that was to be built, say, on the outskirts, that would, for decades to come, establish certain difficulties on that population, maybe more so than others. So there's a lot at stake in that sense. And Attorney John Walker was complaining and speaking to the judge and saying that he feels that his organization has been left out of discussions with the Jacksonville district. And he is quite concerned that the leadership of that district under Superintendent Tony Wood, who's a former education commissioner, and Walker alleges who has a strong direct relationship with current commissioner Johnny Key, that there's a direct line authority coming from the state influencing the selection of contractors who are sort of the go-to companies that may not include a diverse staff or particularly care about giving equal opportunity to minorities, whereas Jerry Guess has a working relationship with John Walker's group, and Walker trusts him to think about the best interests of the desegregation process. So going forward, the state board has reviewed a new plan and agreement by the two districts to adjust some of these conflicts in terms of who's going to have control over what, and it's seems to be unresolved as to how that's going to shake down, because all the judge has restated that Guest does have authority, there's still the possibility of a new plan the state board is reviewing. And so the judge asked all the parties to go back and put their concerns in writing about these issues, because John Walker, as he said, hadn't felt that he had even been a part of some of the recent deliberations. So the judge encouraged them to meet monthly, asked them to have a monthly conversation, and wants to see each side's position in writing.
Why don't we listen to what Walker told you after the hearing?
When you hire the same people to do the work and it's only three or four of them who go from school to school, and they don't have black people on their boards of directors and integrally involved in the operations of the facilities, I am real concerned, because that appears to be racially discriminatory.
So this is Scott Richardson. He's an attorney for a Jacksonville school district.
The facilities piece is the most critical one right now, because we have these deadlines that have to be met very soon in order to set the trajectory for the district for the next 3 years on what its facilities will look like.
So the judge is essentially giving Jerry Guess, as they set up the district, giving him control at this point.
It was established that he had control, and the education commissioner and everyone was on board with that plan. Recently, the filings by the Jacksonville School District asking for control over the facilities plan and raised the question of whether Guess absolutely was going to continue to be in control. And the Jacksonville District is saying that it's a new day and it's a new district and they want to be able to determine for themselves what they do. And then the judge said, you know, this is a new day, but there's this history here that we're not going to jump out of, because the whole purpose of this process is to resolve these longstanding racial inequalities. So he affirmed Guess's control, and then the issue was brought to his attention that there's a new agreement in the works, and so it's not clear what will come of that new agreement if the issue is really resolved as far as some of these details about the facilities plan.
And what's next in the process?
By the end of the month, each side in the case will file a response to the judge's question, and the discussion will go from there.
Well, finally, no news yet, but we expect to have news very soon regarding a big project that a lot of officials are really hoping will happen. Military officials are expected to announce on three dates in the coming weeks if Arkansas will get to build this new generation of military vehicle. This is a project that the legislature in May passed an $87 million bond package to support Arkansas's effort to land this. That was at the request of Governor Asa Hutchinson to build this Joint Light Tactical Vehicle. It would be a $30 billion project, and if it happens, it would be built at one of two Lockheed Martin facilities down in Camden, a longtime military city, but one that has been struggling. If you go through there, you see a lot of empty, abandoned warehouses and military contractors down there. So the hope is that this can really help rejuvenate the state, and in particular, that area with military servicing. Well, the head of the Economic Development Commission, Mike Preston, the executive director, spoke about this earlier this week with Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics. And here's what he told him.
So what we understand is that the announcement is forthcoming. We were hoping it would be a little bit sooner than maybe we would have already known, but as things go in the federal government, sometimes they get delayed. And the latest that we understand is that announcement is going to be coming in the next few weeks, either on August 28th, September 4th, or September 11th, all of which happen to be Fridays. So on one of those Fridays, in the span of 3 weeks, we should have an announcement from the federal government, the Department of Defense, on who's going to win that contract, and fingers are crossed, and hope it ends up in Arkansas with Lockheed Martin.
So note that on your calendar there, those three dates. The two other defense contractors who are also bidding for this project are Oshkosh Corporation and AM General. But if Lockheed Martin gets it, yes, it would be built here in Arkansas. Well, with that, thanks for listening. This has been KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Sarah Weitz-Kotacek was also with us this week. If you're not subscribed to the podcast, we hope you will go to iTunes and subscribe to it. You can also listen to this on our website, KUAR.org. KUAR is a service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and our theme music is by Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.